This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Support for the Memory Palace comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/memory. That's odoo.com/memory.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. The wanderings of the old prospector had taken him all over the Paranagat Valley, to the green ribbon pulled up from the desert floor by the Tonopah, and up and over and up and over the mountains, barely tall enough to qualify, never tall enough to break the heat of the Nevada desert. There were silver in those mountains, but the prospector never found any of it. He was just one of the lost men who had come west after the Civil War, who went to that wild and lonely place dreaming of metal, but only got rocks. And one day he wandered into the storefront office of a newspaper with a bag full. As the brief article in the Daily Territorial Enterprise recounted, this prospector in his wanderings had some years before come upon some strange stones. They were nearly perfectly round, odd to find anywhere, especially so far from sea. And the Tonopah River was only a river intermittently. Each stone was about the size of a shelled walnut. But if you held one in your palm, rolled it around a bit, it was much heavier than you would have guessed. The prospector had found them scattered about a desolate patch of desert. Though scattered wasn't quite right, because the stones, wherever he would find them, there in the shimmering heat, in some indentation in the flatland, some depression left by pooling water that stopped pooling there long ago, they were clustered, like eggs in a nest, as though drawn together by some mysterious force. And then the reporter saw that force in action. Watched how the stones, when spread out on a table, strewn across the floor, rolled back together again under some invisible power. The reporter and the prospector did experiments and found that, even though some individual stones may have been more powerfully attractive than others, if you place one anywhere within about 5 feet, it would roll on back to join its fellows. The article made the same conjecture that you are probably making right now, that the rocks were magnetic, and left it at that. But word of the traveling stones of the Paranagat Valley traveled. A marvel of its own when you think about it, that a simple article, just shy of 250 words, in a regional paper headquartered in a not particularly booming boomtown in western Nevada in 1867, could find its way around the world, yet. The office of the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise began receiving letters, rolling in slowly at first, written by other would-be prospectors wondering if there might be some money in mining magnetic ore, by metallurgists and the merely curious, wanting more details, or a set of stones for their own. But then things picked up speed, like, I'm sorry, I've been trying to think of some simile here about something gathering momentum, or maybe about things being drawn from one location to another by some sort of physical force, but I keep coming up short. Anyway, the letters kept coming, for years, from everywhere, as this article made its slow 1860s way across the globe, from an ecstatic German philosophical society who seemed certain the stones held the answers to long-lasting questions in the study of electromagnetism, and from the desk of P.T. Barnum, the world-famous showman, who offered to buy the stones for $10,000 so he could take them out on the road. But the article's writer, a heavy-browed, goateed fellow named William Wright, who wrote under the nom de plume of Dan DeQuille, couldn't accept the offer. He didn't own the stones. Nor did the prospector. Because there was no prospector. And there were no stones. As a scammer like P.T. Barnum maybe should have known. The story of the story of the stones of the Paranagat Valley did indeed begin with a stranger walking into the offices of the Daily Territorial Enterprise in western Nevada in 1862 on a hot August day, as August days tend to be there. William Wright was 32 years old at the time, a son of the Midwest. He started writing for newspapers at 18 back in Iowa. but he had put down his pen to see if he could make his fortune in the silver mines out west he'd been reading about. And when he didn't strike it rich, he settled in Virginia City and became one of those men who'd write about those who did. And one day, this hot one in August, comes in a skinny guy in his 20s, wavy dark hair, florid mustache. Another Midwestern kid who did a little writing back home and went west to mine silver and went bust and went back to journalism. His name was Samuel Clemens, and this is the part of the story when I slide into smooth storyteller voice and say, you might know him better, dramatic pause, as Mark Twain. Samuel Clemens and William Wright became fast friends. And for years there in the 1860s, they were as thick as thieves. Roommates, drinking buddies, they had adventures. Everything felt like an adventure there in the West when it was still wild, when the land was still unsettled, when the tensions between the people who had always lived on that land and those who'd recently shown up were still unsettled. When every prospector had a tall tale to tell you, maybe have some magic rocks to sell you. They drank it all up together, and they laughed. That was a big part of their thing, pranks and gags. And Wright, being older, having written longer, encouraged his young friend, encouraged him to lean into the jokes. They'd talk about writing, they'd read each other's stuff, they'd egg each other on. And this is when Samuel Clemens became Mark Twain and took on his jokey pen name, and Wright became Dan DeQuille. And this is also when Mark Twain started to become Mark Twain, started writing his own tall tales, with his friend cheering him on, including two hoaxes that ran in the Daily Territorial Enterprise like straight news. One about a father whose failed investment in a San Francisco utility drove him to murder his own family, and another about a petrified man found in the forest. And Twain was so skilled, even then, so early in his career, that he managed to thread that necessary needle, knowing just how to lead the close reader to outrage or to wonder just far enough before releasing them and making them feel good for figuring out the gag. And when Twain left off to California, off to write about a famous jumping frog and all that followed, he never forgot his friend Dan DeQuille. They were made of the same stuff. He was always drawn back no matter how far his travels took him. He'd stay with him every time he passed through town, and always remembered the way he'd made him a better writer, a braver writer, how he helped make him Mark Twain. And Dan DeQuille would say the same. His own career out there among the miners was that of a minor Twain. He wrote straight journalism and travelogues and the occasional short story, all infused with the sense of wonder and wit the two friends brought out in each other. He even followed the younger man's lead and wrote up a hoax. The story of the story of the traveling stones of the Piranagat Valley is the story of a man who was no Mark Twain. The two friends may have been made of the same stuff, but some individuals are more powerfully attractive than others. And while it was a bit of a kick to get that first flurry of mail from gullible readers, a couple of years into it, Dan DeQuille started to get annoyed. There were a lot of letters. But what's more, each Easterner writing for a stone, asking for a bit of magic of their own, each Midwesterner with a get-rich-quick scheme, each researcher earnestly reaching out for a chance to make a contribution to the body of human knowledge, each letter was an implicit critique, a thumbs-down review of his writing. He had attempted to walk in his friend's shoes, and he failed. There was no wink to the truth of the hoax, no little impossible detail, no sneaky pun, no clever Twainian joke that would tip the writer's hand at the right time. For that matter, the stones were not a petrified man, or moon beavers, or a fishtail sewn onto a monkey and passed off as a mermaid. As hoaxes go, it was pretty anemic. In some dry and scientific language, DeQuille dispassionately described a plausible phenomenon, plausibly. So, gotcha, I guess. And the letters kept coming. So many that 6 years after the original article, Dan DeQuille decided it was finally time to show his cards. He posted a little notice in the newspaper in which she said that no one at the paper had any stones, and if anyone was looking for them, they should write to his old friend Mark Twain, who was known to have 15 to 20 bushels. But his little notice was little noticed. And what's worse, his little Twain-style twist about Twain didn't land in the way he'd wanted. He had grown as a writer in the intervening years, in reputation and in skill, but still, Dan DeQuille was no Mark Twain. and the letters kept coming. The German scientists were particularly dogged, and they began to accuse him of hiding something, of committing crimes against the scientific community. After 15 years, and many bushels of mail, Dan DeQuille had dealt long enough with the long tail of his 250 words, so he wrote another article, 470 words, a confession that stated plainly that there were never any stones like that, a plea to stop asking him about it, and a lament, both for a joke gone wrong and for a time gone by. A time when his corner of the country was still unexplored, where he could believe that just about any kind of wonder could be in them thar hills, punctuated by a line of longing that could have stood shoulder to shoulder with the best of twain. He wrote, "We solemnly affirm that we never saw or heard of any such diabolical cobbles as the traveling stones of Peronagat. Something of the kind somewhere in the world." This episode of The Memory Palace is written and produced by me, Nate DeMayo. Get research assistance from Eliza McGraw and engineering assistance from Elizabeth O'Bear. The show is a proud member of Radiotopia, a collective of independent podcasts from PRX. If you ever want to get in touch with me, you can through nate@thememorypalace.us. You can follow me on Facebook or more frequently on Twitter at The Memory Palace. Talk to you again.
Radiotopia.